to get us started, Reverend Teresa Downey is an Episcopal priest and has been in the parish and has moved into, you know, Martine Rafinan, used to be a director of Missouri Jobs with Justice. Martine is doing an interim for a church. So he passed his successor along to us for today's conversation. So, Reverend Downey.
Okay, I don't usually use a microphone, so if it is needs to be raised or lowered, let me know. Good? Okay. So I intend for this to be a discussion, not really a formal presentation. I'll introduce myself. I'll introduce Missouri Jobs with Justice, although it sounds like a number of you are somewhat familiar with the group. We'll talk a little bit about why economic and social justice is important for Christians. Again, I think you all have some idea about that. I'll talk about a recent, very powerful Lutheran action that happened in St. Louis. And then I've got a few handouts and some more information about what's going on right now. And I have some slides that will go along with our 2017 annual report is at the printers right now, so I brought the 2016 one, and some of the slides go along with that. But we do all the same kinds of engagements and actions, so it'll give you a taste with pictures of what we do. So, yes, I'm the Reverend Teresa Downey, and I've been an Episcopal priest for 14 years. I served in a parish at St. John's in Tower Grove for 12 years, and then needed a break. I had a third child. I wanted to finish my Doctor of Ministry after many years of working on it. And then Martine retired, and I had been on the leadership team and the Workers' Rights Board of St. Louis Jobs with Justice since it was St. Louis and not Missouri Jobs with Justice, so for over 10 years. And so it was a good fit, especially because Martine was sort of developing the position and he did stuff all over the state. And the decision was that we should have it be regional. And so it meant that the position that I would take would be part-time and not involve a lot of travel, which would be good because I have three young children. So it's been a great fit so far. I've been on staff since August. I joined the staff union last week. I'm excited about that. After 25 years of being engaged in worker justice, I'm finally a member of a union, so feels good. In terms of my background, I'm from St. Louis. Sue knows me. Christians in the Choir was my French teacher. Then I went to Yale. Then I worked at Yale. Then I went to University of Chicago to do a master's in public policy. Then I went to New York City to do my master's of divinity at the General Theological Seminary of the Episcopal Church. And then I moved back here to restart a parish, St. John's Tower Grove. So I've always been involved in justice work and always worked part-time or on a volunteer basis for worker justice organizations. And the reason I say I don't have a conversion story as a Christian because my mom was a missionary kid, and she eventually left the tradition she was raised in and became Episcopalian. So I was always in the church my whole life, and I was always being asked if I was going to be a priest. And so, I mean, that was never a question, but I had a conversion experience to the labor movement when I was in college. So I was with the Episcopal Church at Yale, and we were working at a soup kitchen at Trinity Church on the Green, and I encountered workers that I knew worked at Yale. And so I just started asking myself, why do people who work for a billion-dollar corporation, I mean, Yale is much richer than many countries in the world, why are they at a soup kitchen? And from there, I had friends that were already involved in the Student Labor Action Coalition, and I got involved, and the rest is history. But it's really been a journey and been about walking alongside people who are trying to have dignity in their workplace, which is often more important to them than even their salary. And I'll talk about a current strike that's going on that you can support in the St. Louis area later. So, any questions from that?
So the people that were at the soup kitchen were clients getting meals?
They were employees of Yale.
They're employees, people who worked at Yale.
Oh.
Yeah.
What is your project for your doctorate ministry?
I could talk about that next year. I'll come back and do a presentation on that. But briefly, it's about the unfinished work of women's ordination in the Episcopal Church, specifically about how in terms of feminist ecclesiology, we're not there yet, and also in terms of course, pay and hiring and all that. But that's typical across, I'm sure it's true in the ELCA as well. It's just that my advisor didn't want me to go too ecumenical, lest I never graduate.
It should be noted, though, we have two bishops who are both female. So
out of how many bishops?
I know, I agree, but I'm saying the Episcopal Church and the ELCA at least.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And an archbishop.
Yes,
so
yes.
Bishops.
Yeah. Well, as we know, President Obama solved racism, and I'm sure that our female bishops have solved sexism in the church, too. So that's me, a little bit about me, and I think Valerie already said, yeah, I can come back and talk about my doctorate ministry work next year. So Missouri Jobs with Justice, as I said, started as St. Louis Jobs with Justice about 15 years ago. We've only had two executive directors. Laura Granich was the initial organizer and the executive director until 2016 was her last year. And now our executive director, who's based in Kansas City, is Caitlin Adams. We now have offices in Kansas City, St. Louis, and Springfield. We have Faith Labor Alliance Breakfast, which some of you may have been at, and I'll talk more about later, in Kansas City, St. Louis, Springfield, Jefferson City. We're trying to develop them in Cape Girardeau, St. Charles. So the work is really spreading across the state, which is really good and really powerful, especially in a year, 2018, when we have things on the ballot like repealing right to work, and we're hoping to have raising the minimum wage and Clean Missouri on the ballot as well. So it's great to have a statewide organization. It's hard to keep track. I think we have 15 people on staff, and 15 years ago started with just Laura as an organizer. So it's been a lot of development. And we're part of a national coalition of Jobs with Justice groups, but each one is organized independently and then is part of a national network. And there are national campaigns as well as our local campaigns. And you'll see it when you look at the annual report, there's, for example, when Pudzer was a nominee to be the labor secretary, that was a national campaign, but St. Louis took the lead on that because he was the CEO of Hardee's and Carl's Jr., which was based here. So, the official introduction to Jobs for Justice is that we're an action-oriented, long-term coalition of faith, labor, student, and community activists and organizations committed to fighting together to defend workers' rights, win more just economic policies, and protect the basic human rights of men and women. Long term, we seek to expand working people's access to collective bargaining, to organize community support for workers treated unjustly or illegally, to increase workers' power to impact their lives through public policy, to make public structures more responsive to the needs of working families, and to address the root causes of poverty while working for an economy and democracy that benefits the entire community. So that's a big, broad thing, and that's why I brought some slides to show you with some more specificity what that can look like in practice. And also, if you want, you can pass these around. This also has a lot of pictures. Like I said, unfortunately, our 2017 one is at the printers, but that will give you some idea.
While she's doing that, could I just ask, what was the social historical context for the start of the national organization?
I don't know, but I will ask that question and I will find out before the next time I'm here. It's a good question. I would guess, based on my, I worked for a sister organization called Interfaith Worker Justice, which was based in Chicago when I was living and studying in Chicago. And typically it's a combination of some visionary leader in a union saying, hey, wait a minute, we need faith and community support in order to accomplish our goals. And people from the faith side particularly, and also community side, saying, hey, we need a way to live out our values, and forming groups in that way. At least that's what I remember for how Interfaith Worker Justice was started, and I would assume it's similar. So a lot of our, this creates some creative tension. A lot of our big money that funds us is from unions, but a lot of our campaigns and a lot of our grassroots organizing comes from our community partners and our faith partners and our student partners. And so sometimes the unions are like, hey, what are you doing in that fight or this fight? And we're like, it's where the people are. We're a coalition. You don't have to agree on everything to do something. So we always have a lot of creative tension around things like that. So I'm going to show you some slides from the Workers' Rights Board annual meeting. This is a yearly meeting of what we call grass tops or champions leaders. It's in my title. I'm the St. Louis Champions Organizer for Missouri Jobs with Justice. once a year, we have a meeting at which we highlight some of the campaigns that we've done over the last year, and we address any issues for the good of the group. All of you are welcome to come to the Workers' Rights Board meeting, and I have cards for the next one, which is September 27th of this year, to get a better sense of the organization. Also, we have the Faith Labor Alliance breakfast, which meet in St. Louis every month except July. October is a combined meeting, and December. And those are the fourth Thursday of the month downtown at Maggie O'Brien's. So I can get your email if you're interested in getting information about that. But it's an early morning breakfast. It's very informative. And then you're done by 9 o'clock, so you can go on with your day. So we usually have it at the Sheet Metal Workers Hall. That's that big LED certified building in Jefferson and Shodo. It's a really remarkable building if you ever get a chance to go to an event there. Similar when we went with Gifted Resource Council to Alberici, right? Mm-hmm. It's a very similar building. They may have built it, I'm not sure. So these are our members of the Workers' Rights Board Steering Committee currently. Ruth Arisman is a Roman Catholic lay leader, and she's with Vision for Missouri's Children. Tommy Pearson is the pastor of Greater St. Mark Church in Ferguson. Sherman George is the retired fire chief for the city of St. Louis. Don Gilgem is with the Workers' Education Society. Percy Green is a longtime activist, if any of you remember the Jefferson Bank strike, and he climbed the arch. Yeah. Christine Gunther is one of our leaders in Tri-County, which is St. Charles, Warren, and Lincoln. Jerry Hochstein was an attorney. Audrey Hollis is also a pastor at Greater St. Mark. Cynthia Holmes is on the board of Americans United for Separation of Religion, is it Church and State or Religion and State?
It's been Church and
State.
Yeah. Denise Lieberman is one of the premier attorneys for voting rights in the country. Alan McNeil teaches economics at Webster. Rudy Polito is a retired Baptist pastor. Martin Raffanon just resigned from the Workers' Rights Board, but he can never really resign. Cherie Saunders is an AME pastor. Ben Centuria, I'm not sure what officially Ben Centuria does, but he's everywhere. C. Jessel Strong is an AME retired bishop and with the Clergy Coalition of St. Louis. And Joan Suarez is one of our founding activists. She's the head of Bread and Roses, which does really remarkable theatrical performances, including one they have today at the History Museum, I think at 3 p.m. So that just gives you an idea of who's in the Workers' Rights Board, what the scope of the folks are. This was an action with Show Me 15 workers. Does anybody know what Show Me 15? Have you heard of Show Me 15 before?
No.
Show Me 15 is part of the national movement called Fight for 15, and it was started with fast food workers who are trying to raise their salaries and get dignity in their workplace. There's Martine getting arrested. I'm supposed to use the pointer, right? There's Martine getting arrested. There's me with my newborn, so I wasn't getting arrested. This was a rally at the McDonald's on Hampton, and I believe that was right after the 2016 election. So you see there's a bunch of clergy and community people here blocking Hampton, and you're about to get arrested. Oh, there's Pudzer. Oops. So again, this was a national campaign to hopefully get Pudzer not to be the nominee for Labor Secretary. And then it turned out that he had some tax issues, but he did blame us for withdrawing his nomination, so that was good. Not us specifically, but he blamed like activists and bad will from the community. So this is a huge fight that's still going on. Do you recall, I don't know if anybody lives in the city, but the Board of Aldermen passed an increase in the minimum wage in 2015. We fought for that very hard. I spent most of that summer in City Hall. It was surprisingly difficult to get, you think naively going in, oh, well, they're all in the same party, they'll all agree to this, right? Oh, no. There's a lot of personalities in that building. And a lot of people wanted credit for it. So it took a long time, and it took that whole summer to get the minimum wage increase to $10 an hour in 2015. It then went to court for 18 months. Finally, the Missouri Supreme Court ruled in our favor, and we had victory for a whole day. This was our day in March of 2017. And the next day was filed in the Missouri State Legislature a preemption bill to say, no, you can't vote to increase your own minimum wage. And so that's why we have the campaign now, because their argument is you have to raise it statewide. So now we say, okay, we are going to raise it statewide. That's why we have the ballot initiative going to raise the minimum wage statewide. It won't be 10, but it will be 12 by 2023 if it's passed. So it's a gradual increase. Starting off equal to Illinois, if we pass it in 2019, it would be about equal to what Illinois' minimum wage is now at $8.60. But this was our day of celebration. Yes, and then we had an outside rally, although by this time we knew that we would only have the raise from May until August of 2017. So you can imagine there's actually, if you look online, I think it was Al Jazeera, AZ Media did this piece, really heartbreaking piece about a worker who, because the increase was coming, he quit his second job, he went back to school, he had a plan to get out of his service sector job, and then he found out that the raise was getting taken away. This is a Justice for Janitors campaign, always ongoing. This is where I'll tell you about a wonderful Lutheran action that happened this year. Got to get the letter out here. Do any of you know Jeff Lindgren?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, Jeff was at a Faith Labor Alliance breakfast and was hearing from workers at Express Scripts, who are contracted under Centaur Building Services, that they were really getting a lot of disrespect and mistreatment on the job, that they were really trying to pressure Express Scripts to hire a different contractor. I've learned a lot about custodial contracts. I didn't realize the workers would stay, but the management would change. So the workers can advocate for Express Scripts to hire a responsible contractor who would pay a better wage and give them better working conditions, but they would stay at Express Scripts. And Jeff really caught on fire about this, and he found out Express Scripts is the prescription manager for the ELCA through Portico, right? And so he wrote a letter And then he brought it to the Lutheran Leaders and Mission of Greater St. Louis meeting. And he brought workers and he brought organizers. And he brought this wonderful document called Sufficient Sustainable Livelihood for All. Are you familiar with this? It's from adopted by more than two-thirds majority by the 6th Churchwide Assembly of the ELCA meeting in Denver, Colorado, August 16th to 22nd, 1999. So I'm assuming it's available on your national ELCA website. I would think that's where he got it. So he took materials from this, and he wrote a letter to the CEO of Express Scripts, which got signed by 20 ELCA clergy, and was sent to them. And I thought, that's a great idea. I should find out if the Episcopal Church is covered by Express Scripts. Guess what? We are, right? So I was able to get almost 65 Episcopal clergy to sign on, about 20 of whom were local and about 65 nationwide. And I got a call from the CEO's office assuring me that they had received our letters, that they were going to allow responsible contractors to be at the pre-bid meeting. And that's happening this week. So we may need to call upon community and faith partners again to support Express Scripts hiring a responsible contractor. But just these two letters from a few dozen clergy got the attention of the CEO's office. That was pretty powerful. And it shows, you know, when you're putting your values to work, what can happen. So that was something that Jeff, he had heard about this at a Faith Labor Alliance breakfast. He said, I need to find this out. He found it out. He wrote a letter. He used your own documents to make the case, and it has borne fruit. This is another Save the Raise action in the summer of 2017. Once we knew that the raise was going away. But you may know that in the city of St. Louis, about 200 businesses and organizations have committed to saving the raise, meaning that they either did or they do maintain at least $10 an hour for their workers. And for example, our diocese a couple years ago passed at our diocesan convention that we would pay at least $10 an hour. And so all of our churches have signed, all of our churches in the city have signed Save the Raise. A lot of businesses do as well, a lot of organizations. This is a healthcare rally. Obviously, healthcare is a huge issue for working people. It's funny because it's not our primary issue, but we get grants all the time to work on it because we're effective at organizing around healthcare. So, this was a Save the Raise rally. This is Pat White. He's the president of the Greater St. Louis Central Labor Council. Southwest Diner was where we did it. And this was, again, when we knew that the raise was going away. So this was the launch of the official Save the Raise campaign in the city. Another Save the Raise rally. We've been doing a lot of Save the Raise stuff this year. And I love this sign. If small businesses can save the raise, so can McDonald's. Because small businesses, small nonprofits are the ones in the city of St. Louis that have saved the raise. And it's interesting because for a lot of small business owners, it's also economic. It's not just moral. It's that it takes them more time and energy and investment to train a new employee. And so they don't want turnover. Besides the fact that they know and love each other. And this is Signature Gathering. We did a blitz at the International Festival. That was really crazy because it was like at the Women's March the other week where we had people from like 8 different counties. You never knew who you were going to get. It's very, but it's fun. Does everybody know what I'm talking about when I talk about Clean Missouri and Raise Up Missouri? Shall I explain? Okay. So I also have fact sheets here about this, but there are two ballot initiatives right now that we're trying to close up by St. Patrick's Day. One is called Raise Up Missouri, which would raise the minimum wage, like I said, to starting at $8.60 an hour starting in 2019 and raise it gradually to $12 an hour by 2023, by which point we can hope the federal wage would be higher than that, but that's what we're doing. And then Clean Missouri is to do a lot of democracy reforms that we have in many other states that we don't have in Missouri. In Missouri, the number of political donors is going down, but the amount of money in politics is going up, meaning that people like Dave Humphreys and Rex Singfield have a disproportionate influence in what happens in the Missouri state legislature. So what Clean Missouri would do, among other things, is limit lobbyist gifts, would limit campaign contributions. It would make sure that if someone's in politics in the legislature, they have to have a cooling off period before they become a lobbyist, because we currently don't have that. It would fix some issues with gerrymandering. So it's a combination of things. And I have handouts that describe all of those things, but it's things that that grassroots organizations over the last few years have realized have really stymied us both in the legislature and in ballot initiatives, because again, like with the minimum wage is a perfect example. We spent a lot of time doing a lot of work to get the raise in St. Louis, and you know, it eventually passed overwhelmingly. So the people of the city of St. Louis said we wanted this, and then the Missouri legislature overturned it. You know, the people, if they pass something, should be able to pass, to be able to keep it. That's the intent of those. And I have handouts up here. I also have the petitions, both if you haven't had a chance to sign them. I mean, it's been at the Women's March. It's been at a lot of events. But if you haven't had a chance to sign those to help get them on the ballot, I have petitions. We can get that done right after the meeting. I'll be at worship, so, you know, after the service. And I also have handouts that specify these things, because I know that, you know, especially the Clean Missouri ballot initiative is complicated, and I would welcome your signature to get it on the ballot, but I also encourage you to really educate yourselves about all the ballot initiatives before they're on the ballot. In November, and Clean Missouri especially has a lot of details. So, this is supporting hospital workers. That's workers' rights board members standing with them. That was an issue of unfair labor practices, I believe. This is now a current campaign that's going on a lot. This may look very familiar. We're right across the street. Graduate workers at WashU have been organizing for quite a while. Organizing graduate workers at private universities is very difficult. It was going on at Yale when I was there 20 years ago, and I don't think the graduate workers there have been recognized yet. And they had an election, and WashU disputed the results of the election. So now they're trying a different tactic, which is direct recognition by the administration of the union. And on Valentine's Day, they're going to have a rally, so if you want to find out about that, I can get you in touch with the organizer for that. But they're having a really fun, creative way of doing this. Friday, I had the Workers' Rights Board Steering Committee, and we took those little Valentines, you know, like you give to your kids or grandkids for their classes, and we filled out dozens of Valentines that said, "Dear Chancellor Wrighton, please recognize the graduate student workers. Love, Missouri Jobs with Justice." So they're planning to deliver hundreds of those to the chancellor's office on Valentine's Day. So it's a fun, you know, nonviolent, just very fun action on Valentine's Day. And then I don't know if you all have ever participated in the Labor in the Pulpits program. Do you know if you have? I can make sure you do this year. So this is a program that's very dear to my heart that I've worked on for over 20 years, because it started with interfaith worker justice. And the idea is to put faith to work for labor and for worker rights on Labor Day. And so we call it Labor in the Pulpits, Labor on the Bema, Labor on the Mimbar. And you can adjust it, like Rockwell House, which is the Episcopal Campus Ministry, your neighbor here. They do it once classes are back in session. It doesn't have to be on Labor Day weekend. This is, I preached at Christ Church UCC in Maplewood last Labor Day. So what I typically do, and what I did when I was in parish ministry, was ask people to bring symbols of their labor and to offer them at the altar, and then hopefully have some time of sharing as people wanted to see And it doesn't have to be paid labor, right? I mean, I was a full-time mom with no pay for a year. That was labor. I was actually in labor on Labor Day 2016. So you have a variety of symbols, from a hard hat to a stethoscope to a magazine to us. There were stoles up there, so that was the altar that day. And again, our theme was the Save the Rays campaign and kicking off the ballot initiatives last year. So every year has a theme. Every year has resources for clergy and other preachers to help shape sermons or adult education or whatever however you want to do it. It's a very flexible program, but it does take place usually in September to put faith to work for justice. And I'm always happy to be a Labor Day preacher. And this was the Raise Up Missouri initiative launch at Urban Chestnut. Got my colleague John Stratton from Trinity Central West End. Had Steve Sanger and Wyatt Crewson. Some nice unity across the county lines there. And this is collecting signatures. People do it in a lot of ways. Like here, Tom, he lives right across the street from the Tower Grove Park. He set up a tent. He set up a water cooler. He even had a first aid kit. And he got a lot of signatures. And this was our Labor Day rally. Now Show Me 15 is part of a national union of fast food workers. And while they know that it's going to be really difficult to get recognition from McDonald's and Hardee's and all those folks, they're still really trying to emphasize the need for respect and dignity in the workplace and advocating for one another in their workplace, whether or not they're officially part of a recognized union. And we always have a contingent of faith leaders in the Labor Day Parade. CBTU, Coalition of Black Trade Unionists, is a very powerful organization that really combines anti-racism work and work for justice, which is a huge area that we're involved in as well. And here you see folks signing the petitions. There's me in my hat. I always have to have a hat. And those are the slides. But I hope that just gives you some pictures, which is, you know, a little better than me just telling you stories about what's going on. Okay, how much time do we have? 10 minutes?
No, 20.
Okay. 20. That's fine. So I would like to hear from you all. Yes?
I saw several slides, and I'm aware of this, that there was an effort, at least initially, to push toward $15 an hour minimum wage, and that was a national movement, actually. At least it was in California, and I know it was here. But in your presentation, you spoke about trying to get up to $12 an hour. Is there a reason for that?
Well, Missouri's cost of living is less than it is other places.
I see.
We've done a ton of polling around the ballot initiatives. And so we know that if we get this on the ballot, if we get enough signatures, it will pass overwhelmingly. When we did polling up to 15, it would not. And so right now we're only at the federal level, right? So it was basically a lot of people would like it to be higher. A lot of people would like it to be lower. So we're trying to find the middle, right, of what will improve workers' lives in a meaningful way, but will actually pass statewide. So that, and 15 is kind of like, right, we all have our vision for the heavenly banquet, for what we hope for, right? I mean, 15 is kind of like the ideal, right? But 10 or 12 is definitely better than 770. So that's the main difference. So why am I here today? Why are you all engaged in justice work as individuals or as a congregation? Y'all introverts like Episcopalians.
Well, because it's necessary and an effective way to help people when the system is wrong. What interaction do you have with Metropolitan Congregations United, or RISE, formerly Missouri Association of Social Welfare?
We do a lot of coalition work with them. So, for example,
with both of them, or with the
with Metropolitan Congregations United, especially, yeah. So, for example, a lot of the clergy that come to the Faith Labor Alliance are clergy who serve congregations that are part of Metropolitan Congregations United. We're working together on both of the ballot initiatives. For example, we've got all these fish fries coming up in Roman Catholic parishes, and so MCU is going to be collecting signatures at some parishes, and we'll be doing it at others. You know, but we're trying to collaborate on that, even though we each organization has goals for signature collecting.
I get the Jobs for Justice emails. Isn't that a pretty effective way to be aware of, mm-hmm. of what you're doing? I mean, if you,
yeah.
That'd be my recommendation to the members of Bethel.
Yeah.
Do you have any focus on women in the workforce, specifically equal pay and mm-hmm. other issues?
Yes. Actually, I was just at an event for CLU, Coalition of Labor Union Women. It's a huge effort. There's also a specific organization of women in the building trades, because that's a very small minority right now that they're trying to grow. So yes, there are definitely movement in that direction. And one thing that's been very helpful to me is to see, for example, Pat White, the head of the Central Labor Council, say, we need people that don't, you know, he's from a Irish family, so by today's standards, he's white, you know, middle-aged man. He says, we need people that don't look like me replacing me, right? I mean, that the unions are very aware of their own, for the most part, I'm not going to say all. Many unions are aware of the history of racism and sexism that they have perpetuated, and they are really trying to address that. And we are trying to help them and push them in that direction.
I would say one of the reasons we invited you was the increased importance of being informed about really complex issues. This is kind of a segue. When the talk about immigration and preventing immigrants from, especially Mexicans, from coming up to do the undocumented labor and picking our fruit. Mm-hmm. One of the talking points was that they drive down American wages. And I couldn't understand the reasoning. I mean, it's coming from the people that want mm-hmm. fewer immigrants. On the other hand, it seems like there's a real effort to keep minimum wage low on the part of the same people.
Mm-hmm.
So I got thinking, I don't understand the logic behind this notion that the undocumented workers doing labor that we basically don't provide for ourselves, how they're driving down American wages. Is there a complex way in which that's true?
I'm not sure on the specifics of that, although as you yourself said, the same folks that say they're going to drive down wages don't want to raise wages. So I know on the opposite end, we do know that, for example, if right to work stays the law in Missouri, if we don't overturn it, that will drive down wages overall, because union wages and also prevailing wage, which is also an issue in the legislature right now, they set a standard, a higher standard for labor across the board. So I'm not exactly sure how,
yeah.
I mean, The issue more to me is that the same people that say they're going to drive down wages don't want wages to be high in the first place.
Yeah.
I think it's also one of those divide and conquer things, right? Because we should want dignity and respect and fair wages for everybody. It shouldn't be, well, you get this if you're in a union, and you get this if you're undocumented labor.
Yeah.
And in fact, I didn't get to hear the whole thing, but on 1A this week on NPR, there was a whole piece with the Immokalee tomato workers and how they went from basically being in bondage to having a really effective worker coalition, and how that happened. So again, it's necessary that all of us have just, fair, respectful working and living conditions, not just some.
Can you tell us a little bit in detail about custodial janitor jobs? I mean, how much do they make, and why are their working conditions?
The main issues that they're having are with management, and management telling them to do things that are not specified in their job descriptions, and making them work late so they miss their buses, assigning them more, say, for example, more bathrooms per person than they can possibly get done in a shift. A lot of low-wage worker campaigns are really about having control over their working conditions, even more than they are about raising wages, and that's certainly the case with the Express Script workers. One worker who came to the Lutheran Leaders in Mission conversation talked about how his supervisor would specifically make him do far more, for example, corporate-sized bathrooms than he could possibly get done in a shift, and then he missed his bus. And as you know, our public transportation system is not great. And so, you know, it took him hours longer late at night to get home, things like that. Just changing people's schedules around, making things unpredictable so they can't plan the rest of their lives, you know, making it as though the worker's life and work isn't as important as whatever the manager wants or whatever the company wants. Is that helpful?
Is there an inflation factor ever tied to the minimum wage?
Yes.
There is?
Yes.
You mean to your bill, or to?
To the ballot initiative, yes.
Okay. I didn't know if Richard was asking about the federal minimum wage, or?
No, the federal minimum wage is unfortunately set largely by legislation. And if you look at, so this is a whole issue we discussed in my policy school decades ago. The bundle of goods that's put into the baseline for poverty in this country is inefficient and inaccurate. It's based on a bundle of goods from the 1950s indexed for inflation. And now, for example, housing is a much larger proportion of what people spend than food. And also, we need more things. You know, nowadays, in order to live in this society, you need to have a cell phone, right? You need to have access to transportation. So a lot of goods that should be in the bundle of goods for what it takes to live above the poverty line are not considered. So typically, even in Missouri, what it takes to live on a bare minimum is at least $12 an hour, if not more.
With the poverty definition is even more dramatic than what you just said. When they defined that poverty level, it was supposed to be what you could live on for a very short period of time and be defined as in crisis. It was not defined to be a sustainable level of living. This was when you were really in crisis. And the woman who designed it spent the rest of her life attempting to get people to stop using it the way we had. And I think we could probably do more for people by redefining the poverty level than by changing their wages, because then suddenly people would understand that $7.50, which gets you above the poverty level, isn't really a sustainable way to live.
Yeah, and that's been a huge question, is how do we change that? Because, I mean, so many policies are based on it, and it's, like, almost intractable. But thank you for reminding us of that fact.
Can you talk a little bit more about this notion of giving credit or taking credit? You mentioned early on, I think, with the Board of Aldermen, the personalities in City Hall, and so what should how should we look at that? I mean, when you know, when our alderman puts out something and says, "Hey, I did this," you know, how should we evaluate these claims that they make about what they do or don't do?
Well, I mean, I guess in the situation of the minimum wage, what I would say is that we had some champions on the Board of Aldermen who were with us from the get-go that really believed that we should raise the wage to improve people's lives. And then we did a lot of behind-the-scenes work to advocate to get other aldermen on board. Once they vote for it, they're going to take credit for it. I mean, that's just the to me, that's just the nature of politics. That's why I'm not in candidate-based politics. I feel like my role as a Christian is to advocate for policies that I believe will increase the dignity and respect of human beings. And if that means that I'm pushing somebody who wouldn't naturally be on our side, but they vote the right way, I mean, they're going to take credit for it. You know, whether or not they were there kicking and screaming or not. And unfortunately, I also, you know, for better or for worse, I mean, this is something that's said a lot in community organizing. You know, there's no permanent allies or permanent enemies. I mean, I feel like that's how we should live life anyway, is that, you know, someone's not just good or bad. Everyone's redemption is possible for everyone. We have this conversation with my 7-year-old a lot with regard to the president. It's interesting.
What's
No one is irredeemable. Redemption is possible for everyone. You know, so we also aren't going to usually call people out on, if they voted the right way, we're not going to call them out about how we got there, because we want them to be on board the next time.
Actually, my question is with regard, 2 more days, the president's going to give a speech at the State of the Union, and his primary thing he's going to accent is how great the American economy is. You know, the stock market is going great, which he doesn't realize only 50% of America has any of the investments in the stock market, but the stock market's doing great, the economy is booming and all this kind of stuff, and it seems to run totally counter to all the efforts which you and any other justice movement that I've been involved with, you've been involved with, and others, recognizes what's really going on at the grassroots. How does that message get translated better?
I think one hopefully powerful way that will be transmitted this year is through the 50th anniversary of the Poor People's Campaign. I don't know if you've heard about this yet, but there's a movement to do what Martin Luther King was planning for when he was assassinated, to engage in a summer of civil disobedience actions and to really highlight, actually starting with February 12th, there's going to be a group of fast food workers and clergy going down from St. Louis to Memphis to join in an effort on February 12th, because that was the official anniversary of the start of the sanitation workers' strike in Memphis. But there's really going to be a movement, hopefully across the country, of people bringing awareness to the fact that there are people in every situation of life, every race, every county, every place that are struggling to make ends meet, and as you said, are in crisis mode all the time. I mean, the narrative about the American economy is also sort of intractable, isn't it? It's like you're taking the average when there's so much economic inequality in our country. You know, all I can say is, you know, unfortunately what it takes is people getting out on the streets and making their voices heard in large, large numbers, and hopefully media covering that and saying this is what's really going on in our lives, believe us.
Isn't there a bill proposed in the Missouri legislature that would reverse the right to work decision by the legislature, or give us a chance to vote on it in November?
Yes.
Are we behind that?
Yes. So it's going to be called Prop A. You want to vote no on Prop A. You want to repeal right to work. And the question right now is whether or not it will be on the August ballot or the November ballot, because that will not be decided by the legislature until the last possible moment.
We have the least chance to reverse it.
Correct. And also because we had been organizing our campaigns around Raise the Wage and Clean Missouri to have all three be on the November ballot, because we really felt like, you know, there are minimum wage workers who are going to come out for Raise the Wage who will then also vote to repeal right to work, right? We thought we'd have the greatest possible momentum in November. Well, the Missouri legislature doesn't want us to have the greatest possible momentum, so we'll see what happens.
So can we go back to the question before? Mm-hmm. So I'm the data nerd.
Good.
So while Trump wants to talk about the unemployment rate falling, what we need to be talking about is the employment rate falling. Mm-hmm. that while unemployment is very low in this country, the ratio of employment to population is very low relative to history. And that's the number we should be talking about. The people who are in the labor force, a lot of them are working, but many people have been kicked out of the labor force, and those people are not earning any income.
Right, and they're not counted among unemployment,
and they're
right.
not in the unemployment figure. So it's the other number that we should really be getting people to look at. And in, you know, you read a lot of unemployment stuff. It's there. People are talking about it. But it's not what the press understands.
Right.
And so it's not the automatic thing that they look at.
I wanted to give you just a couple resources, and thank you all for this discussion. Thank you for having me. Thank you for the efforts that you all are involved in. I don't know if you all have studied this book together, but this is a classic text. It's called Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger. This may not even be the newest edition now, but it has study guide questions at the back of each chapter. It's by a man named Ron Sider, who's the head of Evangelicals for Social Action. What I love about him and I love about his book is that it challenges people across the theological and political spectrums. I had him come speak to a diocesan clergy event one time, and all of his talk of judgment and fire and brimstone made all of us very uncomfortable. But of course, we were all on board about his progressive politics, right? So he makes everybody uncomfortable. He lives what he preaches. I went to church in Chicago with one of his kids, and I said, "Were you really raised this way, and you know, living this simply?" And they said, "Oh yeah." So he also, this book has lots of tips about simplifying our economic and environmental footprint. But this is just a really good, if you're looking for something that combines a deep theological and biblical analysis of poverty and what we can do to eliminate poverty, this is a great book. The what always sticks with me from it is he says, you know, if salvation through Jesus Christ is the central tenet of Scripture, second only to it is social and economic justice. He says it more eloquently than that, but this is always a touchstone for me in terms of if there's, you know, one book that I go back to be challenged, to be educated, to be reminded, it's this one.
What is he doing now, Mr. Sider, or pastor?
I think he's retired. I mean, he was also at the Eastern University, the Mennonite. He's a Mennonite. He was at the Eastern University in Pennsylvania for a long time.
How do you spell his name?
S-I-D-E-R. I'll put it up. And there are lots of other books out there. I'm just saying, like, if this is easy because it has a study guide included in it, and it's, you know, it's pretty widely available. The universal problem of Expo markers. Let me go ahead out. And this also gives more of a global perspective than just United States. And then I also have up here, as I said, I have more detailed information about Raise Up Missouri and Clean Missouri. I have the petitions if you haven't had a chance to sign those yet. You just need to be registered to vote in any county in Missouri. I have, in honor of Martin Raffanon, ballot fund envelopes to make donations to the ballot fund. He has asked specifically, as people are making donations in his honor, that it goes to the ballot fund. I have save the date cards for the Workers' Rights Board meeting, sustainer cards, and I can take down your email if you would like to be on the mailing list for the Faith Labor Alliance breakfast specifically, or for anything else at Jobs with Justice. And I can also give you my card, although it's already inaccurate, because I was initially the St. Louis Champions Fellow, and I'm the St. Louis Champions Organizer. So, Oh, I was going to close with a prayer. That would be appropriate, wouldn't it? So this is our, in the Episcopal prayer book, the prayer for social justice. Grant, O God, that your holy and life-giving spirit may so move every human heart, and especially the hearts of the people of this land and this state, that barriers which divide us may crumble, suspicions disappear, and hatred cease, that our divisions being healed, we may live in justice and peace, through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you very much.